Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for allowing me to show these results. I'm going to talk about the interplay between pressure and anisotropy-driven instabilities and the acceleration of particles. I'm going to focus on the case of weakly collisional accretion flows, but these results, many of them are more generic than that and can be applicable to other systems. I would like to thank my collaborators who have in different ways contributed to the result that I'm going to show. These are students of mine in Chile. He moved to Wisconsin recently, and Francisco, he's working with Ellen Schweibel, and these other two students are in Chile, and these are my international collaborators that you most likely already know. So the motivation is these low luminosity accretion disks around black holes. The two more like paradigmatic examples are Sagittarius A star and M87. So what these systems have in common is that the collision time of particles due to Coulomb collisions as they fall into the black hole is expected to be much larger than the accretion time when you are sufficiently close to the black hole. Therefore, the dissipation of energy in this system has to happen non-thermally. Okay? So this is important because this allows better interpretation of imaging of systems like M87, interpreting the spectrum of these kind of systems, and also find out possible ways in which ions could be accelerated in this type of accretion flows, as that has been claimed by recent gamma ray observations of the region surrounded Sagittarius A star.
So you said that it must involve non-thermal acceleration, but your slide says it could. Which one do you stand by?
Could.
Okay.
Yes. There is no reason to think that it doesn't involve, but we don't know. Okay, so different ways that this non-thermal acceleration could happen is shocks, magnetic reconnection, stochastic acceleration due to cascading MHD turbulence. And the thing that I want to add to this discussion is whether this pressure and anisotropy-driven instability could also produce some sort of stochastic acceleration, which in that sense would be similar to this process here, in the sense that it requires the presence of MHD waves, turbulence, but it doesn't require the cascading. Okay, so the processes that I'm going to show you happen directly on the scale of the Larmor radius of the particles. It doesn't require cascade. So in this type of system, since we don't have collisions, we expect the magnetic moment of the particles to be conserved. And in an accretion disk, since the matter is falling, you expect that primarily the variation of the magnetic field tends to make it grow. And therefore, one expects to have a delta P, where delta P is P perpendicular minus P parallel, to be larger than 1. Okay, so in that case, the pressure and anisotropy of the ions is expected to be regulated by the mirror and ion cyclotron instabilities, and the one of the Whistlers by the, sorry, the one of the electrons by the Whistler instability. So the picture is that these instabilities are going to grow waves that are going to pitch angle scattering the particles, like what I'm showing here. And what we want to know is whether this scattering, apart from providing pitch angle scattering, could also energize the particles. So the method that we are going to use is 1D and 2D particle in cell simulations using Tristam MP in a Shearing box. So the idea is that since it is difficult to capture using kinetic simulations the whole disk, what the strategy is to concentrate in a very tiny patch of the disk where the magnetic field is being amplified by the turbulence in the disk, basically. Okay, so what we do is to make a zoom in of that region and set up in the simulation box a shearing flow. So basically in our simulations, we set up this shearing velocity that is characterized by this shear rate, which is a rate, it has units of frequency, and it's the only parameter that, in a way, accounts for the large-scale evolution of the disk. We ignore the structure of the disk, the wavelength of the that characterizes the turbulence. We also only care about the time scale at which this turbulence make the magnetic field change in time. So due to flux freezing, and if we put the magnetic field in the right direction, we can make the magnetic field grow. In this setup, if we put it in this direction, the magnetic field will grow and tilt, change in direction. That will produce pressure and anisotropy, and we will trigger the instabilities for a long period. So this is not that we are starting with pressure and anisotropies from the beginning in the simulations. We force them and try to extend this pressure and anisotropy in time by permanently amplifying the magnetic field.
But there's no energy conservation, right? You're injecting energy into the system, so yeah. Is that a problem?
No, because, I mean, we know how much energy we are injecting. We know that it's basically due to viscosity, so we can separate what is energizing the particle, whether it's viscosity.
You can't run this thing forever because then you just blow up, right? So you have to. You cannot run this to steady state.
Well, that's a good question. We don't know if there is a steady state, but I mean.
Well, there can't be a steady state. You're injecting energy.
Oh, okay. In terms of energy injection, yes, I agree. But in terms of particle acceleration,
there's one.
If there were dissipation,
no, there's a pit code. It's a pit code.
I understand.
Yeah.
But I don't see it as a problem because I mean,
I don't know if it's a problem. I'm just trying to understand what you're doing.
No. But I think it's important to emphasize that if we run it for never forever, but I mean for a long time, that is simulating something that amplifies the magnetic field by a large factor.
It's great what you're doing. I wouldn't want to criticize. I'm just trying
to
understand.
Yeah, I understand.
So
yeah.
If you look in the real accretion disk and you select a patch like this, is the energy being injected into that patch?
It must be.
In the real thing.
It should be,
yes.
Yeah.
Right. So
and then the real disk could be radiated away.
We don't have cooling.
Is this an Eulerian disk or an Eulerian patch or Lagrangian patch? I mean, are you... You're
following the flow? Yeah.
You're not falling in, right?
No.
Okay, so
I think you're putting too much stock in time. It's a means of driving pressure and anisotropy.
Yeah.
What's the boundary condition of why if a particle goes out, it's boosted so it comes in?
Basically, it is boosted. I mean, we run these simulations in something that we call the shearing coordinates, so that in those coordinates, the boundary conditions are periodic, but in physical coordinate, you should think about it as the particles being boosted. Yeah.
I think there's some confusion because it looks like you're extracting a patch from the disk, but there's no rotation. It's co-rotating.
There's no
Coriolis. So it's not a rotating. It's a linear shear flow, which you would expect to get at small scales in turbulence. You just get random shears.
Yeah, I agree. There is no, I mean, we are following the rotation of the disk. There should be Coriolis force. I have run simulations with Coriolis force, and that doesn't make any difference.
But I mean, surely, as Matt says, you zoom in on some point in the disk, the shear at that point can dominate by turbulence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not the background shear.
Sorry, one more question. At equals zero, you have how do you initialize the plasma?
It's perfectly thermal, and it's initialized by setting the beta of the plasma, the initial temperature, the initial direction of the magnetic field, and that's it. Okay, so.
You have ions and electrons?
Ions and electrons, yes. So I did a previous study where I did have ions and electrons that were as separated in scale as we could. So the largest mass ratio that we use is 128. This study mainly showed that we can, if we use large enough mass ratios, we can actually capture or separate the physics of the ions and electrons. So for 128, we saw the development of mirror modes, the quasi-parallel ion cyclotron modes, and the quasi-parallel Wiester waves. So we needed a large mass ratio in order to do this separation. But then if we wanted to know what was the effect of the Wiester waves on the electrons, then this kind of study was too expensive. So what we decided to do was to assume an infinite mass ratio and focus on what happens only with the electrons. So the simulation that I'm going to show here, only the electrons can move. The ions are perfectly static. And we apply the shear. So in this study, we concentrated on a temperature of the electrons of 0.28, the rest mass energy of the electrons, which is subrelativistic. It's not completely representative of the region close to a black hole in an accretion disk. But it was our initial study. So what we did was to apply the shear so that the Bx component of the magnet of the background magnetic field grows in time. This is the x axis and this is the y. So we make the magnetic field grow. That produces a growth of the pressure anisotropy that is adiabatic. And eventually, the pressure anisotropy is large enough to trigger these pressure anisotropy-driven whisker modes. And that kind of saturates the pressure anisotropy.
Are the ions moving?
No, they are perfectly static. I mean, they are moving with the flow.
Are they moving?
Yeah.
With infinite mass, but they're just they're constant flow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Beta here is there's no magnetic field in that definition, so.
Beta is two.
It's a comma.
Why?
I didn't see the comma.
Okay.
What is the velocity of the shear?
Okay, here, the thing, well, the velocity of the shear is probably, the thing is, the velocity of the shear depends on this parameter here, right? So this parameter is pretty large in our simulation compared to reality. So even if the size of your box is just a few Larmor radius of the electrons, since S is large, the velocity is kind of large compared to what you would get in a real situation.
Is it supersonic or supraatomic?
I would have to estimate it. Sorry. Why would that be important?
It's by definition is because he's taken the ions to be infinitely massive. So that means that whatever flow it is, the Alphane speed depends on the ion mass. It's zero in its simulation.
Fine.
It's supersonic.
Supersonic.
Well, it would be subsonic if beta is large.
No, supersonic too, because that depends on the ion mass also.
Yeah.
So it's
the thermal over
V shear. Say T plus some TI over MI.
Here I use 1,000 and 3,000.
With respect to the electron,
there's no identity.
That's just a different question.
Is there more?
No, so I mean, it makes
electron out there really
good. Also, the electron Mach number. So the Mach number, I think it makes a difference. You have different regimes, whether you are streaming, whether your shear is faster than the.
But the thing is that the velocity of the shear is decided by S, right? So what we did was to test different values of S, and essentially what I'm going to show you here is totally independent of on S.
Well, if you are always on one side of these two regimes, I understand that it might not change. The question is whether it changes if you are on both sides.
Mass is infinite. Ion mass is infinite.
But there is a parameter here, which is the electron Alphane speed and the electron thermal velocity. So his question is relevant to those velocities.
Right. So that would be supersonic. I mean,
in one case you can sort of shock the electrons, in the other case you cannot.
Exactly. Well, here you won't have any shock because you have a shear.
Local physics. It doesn't matter.
It's a laminar shear.
It's just omega.
Yeah, it's incompressible. It's incompressible.
It doesn't matter. If you develop flow speeds that exceed the electron Alphane speed and electron sound speed, then
their entropy is
Damiano, this velocity profile, if you calculate the nabla v, is zero because it's a shear. You won't create jumps in density.
Not a shock in the sense that you form a sharp.
There's a difference between the velocity of the background and the velocity of the fluctuations that are excited. The background, I mean, if it helps, the same year you published this, we also did hybrid studies of this at even more scale separation, but our electron mass was zero. And we both got qualitatively similar results.
Now, well, he can just tell us the answer. He can tell us the size of the box and the value of S.
I'm just saying, I don't see my answers.
It does matter. The electron Alphane speed is a real parameter in the system.
No, I agree. Yeah, sure, there's...
Yeah, but
it would be nice if we just knew the answer. But I mean, if you don't know the numbers, it's fine. But But it's irrelevant.
It's not obvious to me that you are always in the same regime when you change the velocity of the shear with respect to the thermal speed of the electrons.
But it's massive. It's all now, because this is the background.
This is a local phenomenon. I mean, why?
The edge of your box, your electrons will be
fine. Yeah, but you take half of the equation. You take the value at a half of the.
This is the background. And the only meaningful quantities are the fluctuations. The fluctuations are imposed on this background. So it's the velocity versus fluctuations relative to that.
If I transported this whole room at 10 times the Alphane speed, you all wouldn't notice. why we agree
with that. It's the shear across the box. How that
figures into how much energy you're pumping across the box system.
Because you want to know S times Larmor radius of the electrons, right? This goes as S, thermal velocity of the electrons, divided by omega CE. This parameter is very small, okay? I mean, in our simulation, it is very small, but it's not as small as in an accretion disk where this thing is like 10 to the minus 12.
And how big is your box in ion Larmor?
It's a few times Larmor.
Electron Larmor.
A few times.
Okay.
Because we need to capture only the Larmor radius of the electron.
So that's the answer. Fine.
Okay. All right, so we run this simulation. And we get Whistler waves, which propagate along the magnetic field lines. The arrows represent the background magnetic field. And we see the spectrum of the electrons developing a non-thermal tail. That is close to 3.7, the spectral index. This is after the magnetic field has been amplified by a factor of 3. This spectral index is usually inferred from radio observations of, for instance, Sagittarius A star in its quiescent state. So that's why we found it that it is interesting to try to explore more about this.
Sorry, I don't understand how I'm supposed to be 3.7, because if you ran the code for half as long or twice as long.
we're stopped. No. I mean, we run it by a factor. I mean, we amplify the magnetic field by a factor of 3.
Yeah.
And that's a fiducial value for the amplification. We had no reason to do it by a factor of 2 or by a factor of 8 or whatever. I mean, we are just trying to see what happens.
Are these really parallel whistle waves, or are there some bulk obliqueness to them?
There is some obliqueness, but they are pretty much quasi-parallel.
The little arrows in the direction
of the background magnetic field.
Yeah, they're pretty parallel.
So wait a minute. But the arrows aren't changing direction, or my hand just
are they? Yeah, they are.
The
arrows
rotating.
The arrow initially are pointing this way. And then they go sideways.
That's right. Okay. And the waves follow.
Yeah.
The waves follow, so they look pretty parallel.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you'll get this later, but have you run with higher beta?
Yes. In higher beta, we have no problem. They are always quasi-parallel. When we go to very low beta, they become oblique.
Because I noticed, is this just the background field or are there field fluctuations?
This is just the background field. Okay. Yeah. No, it's all the, I mean, here. It's like 10 to the minus 2 in energy.
But can you run it only until the mean field has rotated by 90 degrees? Or does it make sense to go beyond that?
No, it will never rotate beyond 90 degrees because it's just a shear. So it will make this component of the field grow by arbitrarily large values, but it will never go the other, it will never flip the magnetic field.
So
does your shear at some point get disrupted by this, or are you in these finite coordinates where you impose the shear by
it's never disrupted because you are imposing it all the time.
How? Like are you pointing it at the boundaries or in the box?
In the box. But if in the box.
In the box. So you have that alternative term in there.
Right. But if you did it in the boundary, it would be the same. If you inject the part, if you boost the particles in the boundaries.
Yeah, but they never make it to the other one because they scatter by these whistles.
Maybe you would disrupt the background. Okay. No, here I will never disrupt the boundary.
If you do the launch infinite lines, they will continue to move at the same speed.
Yeah, but electrons can do whatever they want. They get scattered.
Electrons?
Okay, so we wanted to see what was energizing the electrons. And for that, we consider this term, which is what we call an isotropic viscosity, which is a gain in energy, in the internal energy of the particle that is given by the delta P, multiplied by Q, where Q is the growth rate of the magnetic field. One can show that particles would gain energy that way in the presence of this shear. And we checked that that was the case in the simulation box. So that way we can separate what is given the energy to the particle. So we can identify easily this term. But we wanted to know what was causing the non-thermal tail. Okay, so that was done by following the evolution of different parts of the spectrum. So this red line represents the electrons that are thermal. And this gray area represents the electrons that are in the tail, the ones that have the highest energy. And what we did was to calculate the work done by the anisotropic viscosity in these two populations, which is shown by these green lines here as a function of time, and the work done by the electric field of the Whistler waves. So these Whistler waves propagate along the magnetic field line, therefore they have an electric field that provides them with a phase velocity. So we calculated that work for the thermal particles, which are the ones over here, and we see that that work done by the electric field is negative. So that means that the thermal particles are giving energy to the waves the way you would expect for an instability, right? But then the same electric field is doing a positive work on the non-thermal particles, which actually dominates the energization of these particles, because here we have the anisotropic viscosity, and here we have the work done by the electric field. So the particles, the non-thermal particles in this part of the tail are gaining energy from the waves. So in a way, what is happening here is that energy is being transferred from the thermal to the non-thermal part of the spectrum using these waves.
So can you give me a physical picture for how to understand the acceleration by the viscosity?
So this is not acceleration. Yeah, there is a shear, right? So particles, if you are in a background that is shearing, then particles can migrate across that shear, right? So if you have a particle that migrates and the background there is moving, then that particle is going to gain energy with respect to that background, right? But the particles can migrate in this direction. And if the shear is going this direction, they are going to gain energy. But if they migrate in this other direction, they will lose energy. So in order for them to gain energy, they need to move in this direction. So you need a pressure and isotropy.
Yeah, okay, that helps. Yeah. Thanks.
And that is a generic result. But here it manifests through the pressure and isotropy with respect to the magnetic field, because we are in a gyrotropic plasma.
Well, Mario, can I ask something? So if you have no collisions at all, if you increase magnetic field, and mu is conserved, and you increase V-term, and V-term is constant. This is called general acceleration. So you increase
V-term
just by increasing magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this important?
Yeah, it is present, but on top of that, you have this scattering by the particles that redistributes the energy that the particles are gaining. So if you just have that, you will have your spectrum that will just move to the right, but you won't create any non-thermal thing. You will increase the temperature.
Yeah, I'm just asking if this Benetton is the same as the size of the viscosity, because it appears to be the same.
I think I'm going to talk about Betatron at the end. I think it's slightly different to this, but...
But mu is not conserved necessarily. So
no, after you have a scattering, it's not conserved,
so
yes.
The first stage, you can see it as Betatron, and then it's not conserved anymore, so it becomes more like a kind of acceleration.
Yeah.
But
don't you want to increase anisotropy along the field? Because you want the particles to communicate. They can only run along the field, right? If they want to sample the shear, right? Then you want the pressure to be elongated along the magnetic field, not the other way around, right? But with compression of B, you get deeper, larger than B. Am I missing it?
I get your point, but the thing is that, so the magnetic field points in this direction, and they move in this direction, right? Preferentially in this direction. So that means that the shear is doing this, And particles tend to move more in this direction. So when they move from here to here, the background is moving this way, so they gain energy.
How do they cross magnetic field?
They don't cross it. They just go around their Larmor radius. That's enough.
But I mean, when they're moving along the magnetic field, they're going to a different velocity shear, because your shear is this way, and the magnetic field line is tilted. So I'm not sure what's going on here. But certainly they can move along the magnetic field and sample a region of different velocity shear.
Yeah, but they also,
So are they moving across the magnetic field, or is it just okay to move along the field to a region?
How fast does the shear compare to the sound speed?
Again. Okay, it's very, no, but the thing is, okay, imagine the situation where they don't move along the magnetic field lines, okay? If they don't move, and they only do this, they are going to gain energy because of that motion.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's much easier to move along the field, so I don't know.
Yeah, they do both, but the thing is that their perpendicular pressure is larger than their parallel pressure, and that makes a difference.
But then they should accelerate even without these instabilities.
They should get heated without this instability, but they shouldn't necessarily produce a non-thermal tail.
So why? Like, what's the explanation?
Because this is just going to increase their perpendicular pressure.
What selects the particles in the tail?
Hmm?
What selects particles in the tail?
The scattering of the waves. The waves discriminate. They say, okay, from this guy I'm going to get energy, and from this other guy I'm going to give him energy.
Can we hear some more details about the setup? What's the resolution? How many particles per cell? And how long is it run for in terms of the electron gap?
So that depends on the ratio between the electron gyro frequency and this shear parameter, right? So we run three shear times, right? But so it's three times this ratio, basically, and this ratio is 1,000 in some cases, 3,000 in some cases.
Okay.
Yeah. I cannot go to the real values of that ratio because it would be crazy.
But I'm asking is because you have numerical heating also.
Yeah, of course. Eventually, I mean, if
for how it would look at different solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if you go to values of this ratio between cyclotron frequency and S too large, then you run into noise very quickly, partly because your resolution, I mean, as you increase that value, the scattering frequency of the particle decreases because you are driving the system slowly. So the scattering needs to happen slowly. And that means that the amplitude of the waves decreases. And eventually, the amplitude of the waves could become too low for the code to actually resolve those waves. So you and at that point you start heating numerically. So that's why I don't use.
How many particles per cell and resolution do you have there?
Maximum 100.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said you've done this for a variety of S over omega or whatever.
Yeah.
So I would think, at least what I saw online is that the level of the fluctuations. I mean, for the ion ones, right? The level of the fluctuations changes with this parameter. So I would suspect that the parallel that you're forming is also a function of this parameter.
Right. The thing is that you are touching an important point. The thing is that, of course, if you magnetize the plasma more, in the sense that if you make the shear more and more slow with respect to time scale of the plasma, the amplitude of the waves is going to decrease, right? But the system will self-regulate in such a way that that amplitude will always be enough to scatter the particles at a rate comparable to the shear rate.
No, I understand that, yeah.
So that means that after you amplify the magnetic field by a fixed value, mm-hmm. regardless of the speed at which you amplified it, mm-hmm. The number of scatterings that the particles are going to feel is going to be about the same.
Yeah, it's just S beta or whatever.
Right. So that means that the acceleration is going to proceed in the same way.
Except that S gets smaller and smaller, which means your scattering gets weaker and weaker.
But not with respect to S. The scattering rate over S is about the same always.
Sure.
Right. So that means that...
I don't know why normalizing in that way is relevant.
Because S gives you this, the shear rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I run my simulation by my simulation time is, in my case, 3 times s^-1, right? The number of scatterings must be time of the simulation times scattering rate, right? So this is 3 s^-1 times scattering rate, which is proportional to s. So this is constant, right? So the particles are going to experience the same numbers of scattering regardless of the value of s.
No, I understand that.
So that's
No, no, but I guess I just don't understand what actually produces the parallel. The number of scatterings is the same, I get that, but...
So then the next thing is, what is the energy that the scatterings give to the particle? But that depends on the phase velocity, of the group velocity of the waves, which doesn't depend on s, right?
I have an issue with this. I'm understanding this. So since that we said that the particles are subsonic, so basically they travel more along y than they drift with the shear, right? Electrons.
So they don't go very far. They're magnetic.
Yeah, I mean, they are gyrating, that's fine. But if we look in terms of displacement along x and along y, they travel more along y than along x. So when particles go out on the top side, or on the top boundary, they come in from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But then at that point, they see the background velocity for them changes abruptly.
No, well, yeah, I mean, then you have to use the proper boundary conditions, right?
But how can you, I mean, the velocity on the top boundary is, say, negative, and on the bottom is positive. How can you still
physically, you boost the particles. You move, that's physically, because that's not what I do in the code, but what I intend to do in terms of the physics is to boost the particles. So they come with a certain velocity, but also they move with the flow, right? And then you want to inject them back in a flow that is moving the other way, so you just boost the particles.
But you also flip their velocity?
Yeah, it flips it by 2.
But then,
no.
But then if
if in this frame it's moving this way,
right?
So when it comes over here, it keeps going the same way, or you flip its velocity?
No, I don't flip the velocity, I just boost them.
So isn't that acceleration?
Yeah.
Why would that be an acceleration?
Then not all the particles are in the same frame.
Of course, yes. They are moving with the shear flow. Yeah. So what I want to know is what is the evolution of their...
By the amount of the shear flow.
Take
a velocity is moving, particle moving with some velocity. He brings it in the other side, but then shifts it by the shear flow across the system. I mean, you can see where you could do that anyhow.
I mean, it's a million cool ones.
Just so it has the same velocity with respect to the local flow speed.
Yeah.
But they kind of
end. But the local magnetic field is pointing in some weird direction.
Exactly.
Weird direction. So it's not entirely clear to me how that works.
Exactly.
I don't know either.
This question never died, though.
Yeah, I mean, I thought after now we would understand the Schur box well enough. It's an accretion disk, there's gravity at play.
No, but now that we're talking about a kinetic particle that can travel the whole box and impede it, do you get acceleration from just traversing the box?
So
if you just have one single particle, right?
Yeah.
Forget about magnetic field, but you're boosting it.
I mean, yes, you get acceleration.
Yeah.
You increase p per.
Right, so wouldn't you...
That's fine.
But wouldn't you disproportionately do that for faster particles?
Yeah.
Gain more energy.
Exactly. No, it's just because they cross more times.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, particles do gain energy.
Do you have like a test particle run with no fields?
The thing.
Well, you can make
the thing is that what I care about here is the thermal velocity of the particles. Their velocity with respect to the background, and that doesn't change if I boost them. The whole idea of boosting them is that if I go to the frame of the flow, their energy doesn't change. So that's...
So you measure the tail relative to the local flow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the thermal energy that I care about, not the if I look at from outside, yes, they do gain energy.
But you're confident that the if you had no turbulence, you would not be getting particle acceleration in this geometry?
Well, you don't.
Well, you would get heating.
But the fastest particles, they will cross the box more often.
Exactly.
So shouldn't you get this proportional energy gain for fast particles?
Yeah. So if you do this in a hybrid car,
it would be really cool to see.
Well, I think that would be that's a possibility, yeah.
But you can check this, but if you make the box bigger, the fraction of particles that, since it is a boundary, like a surface effect, the fraction of particles that cross the boundary increases. So you can check whether the spectrum
when it crosses the boundary.
It should be.
I'm not. The thing is that I do all my calculations in the frame of the flow, yeah. Right? So what I measure is their energy in that frame, which is not that unique frame. It depends on the position, right? So that's all I care about, their thermal velocity with respect to that frame.
Peculiar velocity. Yeah, but keep in mind that since the magnetic field has a large component in the y direction, your particles keep jumping frames effectively. So, I mean, I think that was...
Yeah, especially if you want to compare, if you derive a power law that is basically appearing in this frame that doesn't exist in nature, because every particle on that plot, on that histogram, lives in a different frame. It's not obvious that if you observe this, you should see that slope in a real disk where there is...
I mean, if you sit in the disk and move with it, yes, you will see that the distribution.
If you look at the disk from outside...
Oh, of course, and the same thing happened in a shock and everywhere. I mean, you measure thermal distributions locally, right?
This way, if you have cold particles that are shearing and you look at them from outside, you see a spectrum of velocities. Yes. And so this is important when you compare
I absolutely agree, but I'm not. This is representing
the observations.
What is observed is this retroalimentation, which is happening in the frame when electric field is zero, it is only frame. And if the motion is not relativistic, then the boosting effect is not strong. And what you observe is really a velocity distribution in the frame where moving is applied.
Okay, I suggest we move on. I think you have 80 slides, and we're left on slide 6.
No, a very quick one. So did you check like a temperature mountain, whether there are regions that have a different temperature, such that the power law would be just a superposition of much gradients of increasing.
It's completely homogeneous. It's a homogeneous system in this local commoving frames.
Where homogeneous, you wouldn't have an isotropy.
No, that will be an isotropic.
Yeah. An anisotropic thing cannot be
homogeneous.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, I mean...
But you have a distribution of temperatures.
Yeah,
you have particles that have different temperatures.
Okay, I already said this. Okay, so I'm going to go quickly on this. This thing works better from betas of order unity. When we go to beta larger, the efficiency of the acceleration decreases, and that could be understood in the framework of the stochastic second order Fermi acceleration, but I'm not going if I start going into that, we are going to stop too much. I want to mention that we also tested this magnetization parameter, this cyclotron frequency of the electrons over the shear rate of the plasma. As I already mentioned to Matt, the acceleration shouldn't depend on this parameter, and we did test it for magnetizations of 1200 and 3000. As I already mentioned too, we cannot go beyond that because of numerical reasons. But we have tested this, I think, enough. I mean, yeah. Okay, so the...
But what are you saying? It doesn't depend on the shear rate?
It doesn't.
But I mean, how can that be? Because if you didn't have any shearing, you wouldn't have anything, right? So.
No, you need a shearing, but you can make this quantity arbitrarily large. That's my claim, and that's because It will always happen. It doesn't matter how small you make S, you will always have the same number of scatterings of the particles after you amplify the field by a fixed factor.
Zero shear is a singular limit. Zero shear is a singular limit.
Yes.
Are you,
I mean, you need shear. You need shear, but you can make it slow.
Is it to do with the amount of time this takes? So, so the lower is the shear, the longer all this takes.
Right.
So at zero shear, it takes forever, and therefore.
Exactly. You would have to wait infinite.
Are you plotting for the same total amount of magnetic field amplification?
Exactly. Like that's the thing. That's the thing.
When it's going slower, but it integrates longer.
Exactly. Because if I run it for a fixed number of shear times, then I'm going to amplify the field by the same factor.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so what I'm doing now to extend this work is to go to larger values of the temperature of the electrons, because in this type of accretion disk, you expect these electrons to be relativistic, right? So when one goes to that regime, we tested different relativistic values for this ratio, and we what we see is that the acceleration is most efficient in beta, initial beta equal to 1, and it decreases for lower beta, and it decreases also for larger betas. Okay, so it's maximum at beta order 1.
Do you start with a quadro Maxwellian distribution?
With a Maxwell-Jutner distribution.
But you start with hot electric.
With hotter temperature, but perfectly thermal. So one thing to notice is that this spectral index is less hard than in the lower temperature case. The interpretation for that is that when you go into the relativistic regime, these instabilities take longer to grow. They need larger pressure anisotropies. So they are triggered later. So when one goes into, when instead of amplifying the magnetic field by a factor of 3, which is given by this running time of equal to 3. Instead of that, we go to running time of 6, which means the magnetic field is being amplified by a factor of 6. We recover this power law tail with the spectral index close to 3.7. So,
what's the maximum power law index?
We don't know. The short answer is that I haven't run this thing forever, actually. Yeah.
And what about after 1? Because that's sort of the time scale you expect it to change itself on.
Sorry, I didn't get.
Also, 1 shearing time would be the time scale you'd expect the shear to switch, in a sense. If we're
right.
Talking about 2,
right,
so
but
what do you get after T?
After 1, you get pretty low acceleration. You need like significant amplification of the magnetic field. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What happens with the ions? We believe it must happen something very similar. One of the differences in the case of the ions is that here we don't have only one instability that is providing the scattering. We have mirror and ion cyclotron waves. When we are in the regime beta of 2, the scattering is expected to be dominated by mirror. And in that case, it's kind of not very fun because mirror modes don't have electric fields associated to them the way ion cyclotron waves have. That's because ion cyclotron waves propagate along the magnetic field with a finite phase velocity, which correlates with this electric field here, which is finally what should provide the acceleration. So we don't expect so much acceleration in the cases dominated by mirror. If we go to lower betas, then we do expect acceleration because then you are dominated by the ion cyclotron instability. Okay, so this experiment uses beta of 0.5, temperature of the ions of 0.05, the rest mass energy of the ions, which is representative of what we expect in systems like hot accretion flows around black holes. This simulation uses a magnetization for the ions of 800 and a mass ratio of 2, which is pathologically low, I agree, but I'm going to show you that this whole process doesn't depend on that. Okay.
So now you relax the ions.
Now the ions are relaxed. Yeah.
And does the shear in them persist, or are you just forcing it?
I do exactly the same thing, that just relaxing the ions. Yeah. I apply the same shear.
Are you like there's a hierarchy bump each time you go through a shear time?
Well, here I go to about three shear times.
I see three bumps grow in the accelerator.
Yeah. There is like a power law plus two bumps. I agree. Yeah.
So what are those bumps?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that when you excite these waves and when you amplify the magnetic field for long enough, this whole wave pattern reforms. So first you see like a growth of the ion cyclotron waves. They migrate to longer wavelength, and eventually, since the magnetic field is growing and the Larmor radius of the particles is decreasing, my interpretation is that the system needs to create ion cyclotron waves with shorter wavelength. So, and you see that in the spectrum. In the spectrum, you see kind of bumps in the power spectrum of the ion cyclotron waves that are correlated with the energy of the ions with which they should resonate.
What's K rho I for these waves?
K rho I is order unity, like point.
So this is much longer wavelength than the previous simulation you showed.
Yeah, it has to.
For a mass ratio of 2.
For a mass ratio of 2.
Mass ratio of 2.
Yeah.
Are the ions scattering off the electron stuff?
Well, I don't think so, because when you increase the mass ratio, things don't change.
Sorry, but so initially you had the shear.
Yeah.
Now ions are free to scatter. Doesn't this reduce the shear?
Can you plot the profile of ions? What is the ion velocity versus what?
I don't see how you can.
It's the same as the one of the electrons.
But what is it?
It's a shearing velocity.
Is it still a straight line, or is it all over the place now?
It has.
Well, I don't have that plot, but on average it should be a straight line, but on top of that you have this scattering with the waves.
That's a good story, but in practice it's
exactly
not
like that.
They scatter.
They scatter. And it's not that you have a shear in the beginning, the shear at the end will be different.
You know, the easiest way to sort this out is if you actually follow the particle trajectories and identify the moments where they get energized.
So, but I don't get the issue. What is the issue?
You have a shear in the beginning,
okay,
because you initialize particles with a given velocity,
mm-hmm,
the ions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ions are not forced to move along the shear as in the previous case.
Mm-hmm.
So they can slow down, the shear can be reduced.
No.
I'm asking. Said
no, it won't get reduced because you are forcing the shear.
What do you mean?
Maybe you should show the equations. That
what do you mean you are forcing the shear?
You never show the equation.
I'm going to show that. But
the mean velocity is a function of.
So ions are not free, are not relaxed.
No.
They are being forced to move with the shear at any given time.
Well, they feel this very
energy,
right?
So they get energy from the relationship. This is just because he said free and he interpreted that differently than you're interpreting.
But if
he's free, like they can use it.
But they can't move away from the shear.
But they move.
In a test velocity, the shear velocity plus the flux force.
So can I stop them? Can I? If there is a huge wave, wouldn't that ion create a delta V that's equal to the V shear and stop and decide to go backwards?
Well, then you would see a breaking of the whole profile that I'm putting in the simulation. I don't see that.
So I don't know what your profile is.
How would it do that? There's no preferred location in this box. It doesn't have a spot where it can.
There would be a longest wavelength counter.
Ions are self-consistent.
No, I'm going to do something that is not correct, but I think that may clarify.
There's a force in the momentum equation. But if there's
an extra force,
then it's
they are getting accelerated.
But there's no, it's a homogeneous box. It can't be that
by. He's not.
So this is something that I was going to show later, but here you can actually see more or less what the shear is happening.
Like a hula dance.
So this is a simulation where I excite both mirror and fire hose modes. This is the fluctuations in the magnetic energy, and you see that this is what everybody's doing.
Are you going to cite any of those people that are doing this?
Huh?
Sorry.
This is just preliminary, Matt.
Yeah,
it's preliminary.
Yeah, this
was,
okay.
What are you doing? Are you running this thing backwards? Yeah.
Sorry,
No, the time is going forward. I'm watching. No, but the magnetic field is rotating back again.
Okay, so I guess this is helping with the question that you guys have.
Yes, tell us
okay.
what's happening.
No. Okay, but I'm just trying to show that these simulations do this. They impose a shearing that is forced. That
The shear is flipping sign.
Yeah, the shear is flipping.
Okay, this thing confused you guys more than I expected. I mean, I'm not getting why you.
You are even stupid than the... you
think. Always assume your ideas.
The question is simple. How do you? So you initialize the shear. We understand that.
Okay.
At any given time step, what are the forces that act on the ions?
There is an extra force.
There's an extra force.
Oh, okay. So there are the self-consistent force that depend on the electromagnetic field,
and that's what it comes from a fringe transformation.
Yeah,
you do a fringe transformation, there's an additional inertial force that keeps you in that frame.
No, but then you cannot study. I mean, if you are forcing them to go back to the shear speed, you cannot study if they are accelerating.
There's when you're in increasing risk, there's a Coriolis force, right? But you're allowed other velocities other than the Coriolis force. Here, there's an additional force which is pushing you into the frame of the shear, but you can have a velocity in addition to that.
But you can't study ion acceleration if you are prescribing some ion acceleration.
It's a frame transformation.
It's not free.
They're not forcing any new physics. It's just a frame.
It's a frame transformation.
But hides the assumption that the ions are always going back to that shear.
That's not an assumption.
It is an assumption.
It's not.
This is the
So okay.
This is to see if that assumption, if that is what is happening or not.
You know,
Damiano, look, the idea. Can I explain it?
Sure.
The idea, what this thing is trying to simulate is an infinite system. Let's say, imagine you have an infinite plasma. You don't have the boundary condition issue, right? So you will just have locally a shearing plasma that, of course. If you study the relative velocity of different parts of this infinite plasma, they are going to start moving at the speed of light with respect to each other, right? But what I care about here is the local physics. Okay, I'm thinking that this is infinite, like I'm applying some sort of cosmological principle. Everything, nothing changes in different parts. You just see them weird when you look at from the distance, but you go there, nothing changes. Okay. But I cannot run an infinite simulation. So what I do is to apply periodic boundary conditions that are periodic in terms of the local conditions.
I'm not concerned about the boundary conditions now.
But I think I interpret that you are saying that because of the boundary condition, the particle would be energized in a way.
Now the problem is that at any given time, you are pushing the ions in one given direction, which is the side a priori. Which, in that piece of the disk, there is nothing that it should tell that ion that they should accelerate back at that speed.
Gravity.
No, that happens if the angular momentum crossing time does this. But that is given by the same viscosity that is due to.
By the way, I do cite you, but the thing is that I may not get to the slide where I cite you. I'm afraid that I won't get to that slide.
Okay, Meyer, let's go.
Okay.
Let's assume that this is okay.
And that we understand.
Okay. Electrons. What now we are talking about ions. Okay. So they do accelerate. We.
It is obvious that the ions accelerate.
We agree on that. Okay. So here I wanted to mention that I did 2D simulations with mass ratios of 10. I cannot go beyond mass ratio of 10 in 2D. Okay. So, but nothing fundamental changes. Here I'm comparing beta of 0.5 and beta of 2 in the beta 2 case, we are dominated by the mirror instability, therefore we don't expect acceleration. Okay, so we did the same analysis, and I think I'm going to skip this one because it's exactly the same thing as in the case of the acceleration of electrons. So we wanted to make sure that this whole picture about the independence on mass ratio and magnetization was true. We did that using 1D simulations. In the sense that we take our shearing box and we concentrate on a one the domain, which is marked by this blue line here, the direction of this domain is coincident with the direction of the magnetic field. So we manage to produce waves that only propagate along the magnetic field. And that's fine because we know that what is producing acceleration is either Wiester waves or ion cyclotron waves, and both are quasi-parallel. Okay? So that allowed us to push the mass ratio to larger values. Here I'm using mass ratio of 2 and 128. And you can see that essentially nothing changes in terms of the acceleration. If we go to larger magnetizations, here we are testing from 400 to 3200. And here there is some small differences, but the trend that we see is that as we increase magnetization, there is some sort of slightly harder acceleration. So, but pretty much the slope can be described as a power law with a spectral index close to 3.4 plus these bumps.
So you actually see the more non-thermal particles at lower shear, right?
Is that yes, true? Yes. Yeah.
Well, that kind of answers my next question.
Okay, so additionally, we wanted to make sure that this whole process doesn't depend on the way we are amplifying the magnetic field. So we also tested amplification of the magnetic field with the collaboration with Lorenzo, who has implemented in his code compression of the magnetic field. So in that case, the magnetic field grows due to compression. We tested the same parameters for the plasma, except for the way we were driving the growth of the background magnetic field. And he found essentially the same thing, a sort of power law with bumps, with a spectral index 3.5, and no dependence on either mass ratio. He tested 8 and 16, and magnetization, he tested 1600 and 3200. Okay? So that was what we published. The additional thing we want to do is to explore what is the dependence on temperature of the ions and on the temperature ratio between the electrons and the ions.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So you've got a method that takes this thing and grows, and the longer you go, it's going to get steeper.
Yes.
And you stop because of numerical and limitations. Is there a physical thing that would stop at 3.7 as observed in the...
No.
It seems to me that you're saying you can produce any tail, and what matters now is what limits the observed tail to be what it is.
Right. The thing, I mean... I didn't find realistic to amplify the magnetic field by larger factors.
I get that. Assume you can now make as hard a tail as you want. The question, it seems, you're posing is then what limits the tail to be 3.7 or whatever it was in Saturday Star? Is that an easy answer? Is there some synchrotron?
We are working on that, exactly on that problem, yeah. So, preliminarily we want to see first whether this whole process can be described as a diffusion in energy. And we want to measure the diffusion coefficient and see if that leads you to some sort of steady state in terms of the tail and compare it with the simulations. That's what we are trying to do now. We don't know whether this thing stops at a spectral index of 3.7 or it could continue if you get amplification by a factor of 10, let's say. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so there are reasons to believe that this ratio between temperature of the electrons and temperature of the ions could be important, basically because the growth of the mirror instability also benefits from the pressure anisotropy of the electrons, but the growth of the ion cyclotron waves doesn't, because the ion cyclotron waves are resonant, and they resonate only with the ions. So if we decrease the temperature of the electrons with respect to the temperature of the ions, then you expect the ion cyclotron waves to be favored, to grow more easily than the mirror. And that allows the ion cyclotron instability to dominate even for betas larger than 1, and probably produce acceleration for betas larger than 1. So we tested that. I want you to pay attention to this plot where we use a beta of 2, where in the previous case where the temperature ratio was 1, we didn't see much acceleration, and we indeed tested the case temperature ratio equal to 1, and we don't see much, but as we increase or decrease the temperature ratio between electrons and ions to 1 over 10 and 1 over 30, we start making the tail harder and harder, and eventually it coincides with the tail that we obtain in the 1D simulations. The 1D simulations, as I mentioned, only capture quasi-parallel mode, so they cannot capture mirror. Therefore, they are totally dominated by the ion cyclotron waves. So that means that if we go to temperature ratios of 1 over 30, the scattering of the ions is dominated by the ion cyclotron waves, and they get a significant non-thermal tail. So that's good. That means that decreasing the temperature ratio has an effect that we believe is important in the case of low luminosity accretion disk, because people infer that in those cases, probably the temperature of the electrons is smaller than the ones of the ions. We don't know for sure that, but that's a possibility. The other trend that we see here is that as we increase the temperature of the ions to more relativistic regimes, the hardness of the tail increases. Okay, so this is very preliminary. I don't have an answer of how much it would increase if we go to even larger temperatures. My prediction is that it won't increase much, because the ion cyclotron instability tends to be suppressed in the relativistic regime from linear theory. So, but I still have to check that. So okay.
When you change the temperature ratio, do you change the temperature of the electrons or the ions?
I cool the electrons, and I try to keep the ions in the same region.
Increase the grid resolution and also resolve for the violence?
Yeah. I have to push the resolution. Yeah.
Because
all of these changes require.
In that case, right?
Yeah. Okay. So that's it with respect to acceleration of ions and electrons when we amplify the magnetic field by large factors, which is where these kind of things apply. Okay.
Did hybrid simulations observe this as well? No. Why not?
I think the question is to him is why he solved. I mean, it might have been because of the higher beta.
Well, did you check?
Yeah.
Okay. So one possibility is.
You always get mirrors.
So in your case, the ions are non-relativistic, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that could be, I don't know. But here we see that as we make the ions less and less relativistic, the efficiency of the acceleration is smaller. Well, that could be. But I have some result that could apply to some work that Matt did in using hybrid. This one not, and I think it's because here we are using sub-relativistic ions versus non-relativistic.
Interesting to understand why that mess.
Sorry, I have a comment on that, because for the hybrid codes, you have a problem in this regime, I think, because when the electron temperature is much less than the ion temperature, you get the finite grid instability, and unlike for the full pick, you cannot just make a finite grid and get rid of the finite grid instability in the hybrid. It's Rambo from the 90s.
He doesn't catch the electron.
If you have a small electron temperature compared to the ion temperature,
there are no scales associated with
it. How was the other way around?
All right, let's move on.
Yeah.
Anyway. Sorry, we'll move on.
All you do is turn off the pressure gradient in the
Gauss law. Yeah.
Okay, so far I have talked about processes of acceleration that work in the beta order unity case, and in that case we excite instability that have strong electric fields that can accelerate particles. So if we go to large betas, we don't expect this to happen, right? We don't expect these electric fields to be so strong, because in the high beta regime we are dominated mainly by these guys, right? In the case of the ions, at least, we are dominated by mirror instabilities and fire hose instabilities, as also Matt has studied before. So in that case, the energization of the particles are dominated purely in this setup by anisotropic viscosity. Okay, so the problem with this anisotropic viscosity energization is that if you don't have a scattering by the particles, this whole process is reversible, right?
I don't understand. What are you doing here?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. I know, but I mean, what are you changing now compared to before? I'm totally lost in terms of this.
Well, the explanation could be too long. But what I'm trying to do is to see whether in the large beta regime.
So you're in large beta regime.
Yeah, now.
Okay, now you're in. Okay, so it just doesn't say that in there. It's
fine. But you're always in large beta regime.
No,
before you were beta one.
Larger than one. We are trying to go to the larger than one regime, and in that case.
So beta is what?
10-ish.
10-ish, okay.
Yeah. So when beta is 10-ish, you don't have ion cyclotron, you don't expect to see ion cyclotron. So in that case, the energization of the ions should be due to anisotropic viscosity, right? And we have seen so far that anisotropic viscosity only takes the spectrum and moves it to higher energy, but it doesn't produce tails, okay? So what I'm trying to explain here is that this anisotropic viscosity term is also reversible unless there is a scattering, right? So the idea here, what I'm trying to explore, is whether that scattering acts differently on particles of different energy. So it makes this heating less reversible for certain type of particles versus other type of particles. If that is the case, then the heating itself is going to be non-thermal, right? That's why I call it non-thermal anisotropic viscosity. So that's what I'm trying to explore. And in order to explore that, I need to run simulations where I both increase the magnetic field and decrease it. Okay? So that's what I'm trying to do here. And this is just a proof of concept, mainly because I'm using a mass ratio of 1. Okay, so this is very preliminary. I talked to some of you guys before and I said, should I show preliminary things? And you said yes. Okay, so I'm using a mass ratio of 1, beta large, 10, okay, temperature appropriate for accretion disk. And what I'm going to do is to grow the x component of the magnetic field. Initially the magnetic field points along y, but I'm going to grow this component so that it reaches the ratio between the two magnetic field components is 1. So you can see it here, where this is Bx, it grows with time, it reaches the dotted or the dashed green line, which corresponds to the By component, this guy, and then it comes back, and then it grows again, then it comes back, and then it grows again.
It comes back because you reverse the shape.
Yeah.
This is what Melville did in 2015. Like this, and then this, and then this, and then this.
Yeah.
But we didn't. It looks like we saw different evolution than you're seeing. Right? It's probably the scale separation.
In terms of this guy? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I need to separate more the scales in this.
What do you mean by different evolution? What do you?
Well, remember we said that if you have a phase of Fibro's evolution first, that those scattering sites live long enough to make it hard to drive MIR subsequently, because it was hard to drive the pressure isostropy in the other direction with all these scattering sites.
Yes, so it's very difficult. I mean, if you do this, if you slowly push magnetic field back and forth, but now you have memory effects, it's at very high beta,
yeah.
Right? It's extraordinarily difficult to actually change the magnetic field overall. You can change the mean magnetic field. But you know, the way FIHOS, for example, deals with field being decreased is it creates fluctuations to compensate for the increase in the magnetic energy.
I'm sorry, was yours full pick or hybrid?
So what would happen, right, is that you know you would decrease your field and then your magnetic energy associated with the FIHOS perturbations would grow. Then you would reverse change and you would try to increase the fields. Those FIHOS fluctuations don't really decay very fast. Because actually it's very difficult for them to decay, because if they decay too fast, they themselves start changing field strength and get limited by some kind of secondary FIHOS or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you actually end up with at very high beta. Very high beta, 10 maybe not, but at very high beta with ion hybrid, you end up with magnetic field, which you know you keep changing it, but it's actually magnetic energy is nearly constant. And it just keeps
in the fluctuations you mean?
Well, total magnetic energy.
No, but you're increasing and decreasing the background one, right? So
well, you can't stop yourself from. I mean, you impose this shear which has infinite energy,
right?
Right. So there's no back reaction from anything on shear. But what happens is that the total magnetic energy, if you plot, meaning the field strength that a particle feels at any given place, barely changes as you go in time, which is quite cute. I mean, it's a system kind of. This was before Jono invented magneto immutability, which I keep
exactly, yeah.
Magneto inevitability. But yes, it's magneto immutability.
So yeah, what we would like to do is to implement this shearing thing in a more harmonic way. Like, because what we are doing is to increase it and decrease it, increase it and decrease it. I know that is very unrealistic, but this is very proof of concept in the sense that we would like to see first whether the thing does something interesting. This is, by the way, something that we are doing with Ellen and Francisco Ley, her graduate.
So if you want to model turbulence, you might want to do it randomly.
What, sorry?
If you want to model turbulence, you might want to do it randomly. Meaning at each next step, you randomly decide whether to increase.
Yeah, that could be too. Yeah. Okay, so this is what we get. These are successive amplifications and decreases of the magnetic field. You can see here that when the magnetic field grows, we see sort of mirror type instability. When it comes back, we see more like fire hose. We can see it also here in the fluctuations when the magnetic field is decreasing. There is this component out of plane that is dominating, that is more characteristic of the fire hose. And when it's growing, there is the in-plane component that is characteristic of the mirror. And we do see, by this amount of amplification of the field, the appearance of a non-thermal tail with a modest spectral index. If we go to larger amplifications, we are just playing with this, basically.
When you say large amplifications, you mean large?
So this shear delta B over B now is 2. So
initial or final?
Final.
Final.
So we do...
That's not a parameter, right?
What?
That's not a parameter, delta B over B. That's the outcome.
No. It's a parameter because we decide how much we are going to amplify the field. And
oh, this is delta mean B.
Mean, yeah.
Oh, I see. So this is saying that you have enough shear to double the field. Yes.
Right.
Yes, I get it.
Yeah. So yes, we do see some non-thermal. This is a spectral index of 4.5, which reminded me what you got in an MRI study in 2016.
But that was completely if I stopped the run earlier or later, I think I would have gotten a different answer.
Okay.
I mean, the thing just kept, the power law just kept growing.
Right.
Is this magnetic pumping?
It's magnetic pumping, yeah.
With collision, with not with collision.
Yeah, with collisionless, yeah.
Did you get electron acceleration as well?
Well, here is mass ratio of 1.
So yes.
Yeah, but that's something that we would like to find out, whether one can also get magnetic pumping working for electrons in systems like clusters and stuff like that.
So have you tried changing beta?
The thing is that when you lower the beta too much, you never, you reach...
Five.
Yes, but I did it in the relativistic regime. Because in the relativistic regime, you need larger beta in order to trigger these instabilities.
So the reason I'm asking this question is this. So at every time you have a shear like this, this generates a particular type of microscale turbulence, right? Fire hose or mirror turbulence. When you reverse the shear, that turbulence needs to decay, and so some kind of new turbulence needs to arise, right? The question is, how quickly can this happen?
Yeah.
And how quickly can this happen depends on the beta. It turns out that it's especially for fire hose perturbations. So which means that if beta, as you make beta higher, your perturbations from the previous cycle become more and more resilient and persistent. And at some point, the characteristic time for the previous relics to decay becomes longer than the length of each cycle.
Right.
And then that gets you into a different regime than otherwise, because otherwise, basically, each next cycle is a new life, because you know, your old turbulence just goes away and the new one appears, and you know, all you've got is just a succession. You know, you might just as well do many individual simulations.
Which is basically what we do here, but changing the initial conditions.
Sorry?
This is basically what we do here, like many simulations where the initial conditions of one is the final condition of the previous one.
The question is whether there is a scale separation in time between forgetting those initial conditions.
Right.
And reaching the end of the of each particular cycle of notification. Right. Right. And that depends on beta.
So my question is, I guess it also depends on beta, but it also depends on the rate at which you do the shear, right? Because if you use a realistic value, then you should have enough time for the previous turbulence to decay, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
But for the acceleration problem, this is where your discussion of reversibility comes. I mean, basically what you're doing is giving yourself a much, much longer stretch of time for these this irreversible process to
right.
occur in the yep. acceleration. So, yep. irrespective of whether the detailed fluctuations are...
But that irreversible process also occurs much more slowly.
But the tail can never go back.
Yeah, the tail doesn't go back.
I'm kind of confused by you make beta larger and larger.
It's not reversible, so it's doing this.
If you make beta larger and larger, the damping time gets shorter and shorter because the dithermal is getting bigger and bigger compared to...
No. That's not how they damp. So when
it's not sound wave type.
Well, it turns out that when you're trying to damp fire hose perturbations, right? Think about this, right? You have a bunch of magnetic energy, right? And now they need to damp, right? So try this. You can probe this quite easily by. There's another experiment you can do. You can shear and then switch off the shear,
mm-hmm.
and just let the thing damp.
Right.
And measure how long it takes for the fluctuations to go away, right? So now think about what's involved in them going away. As the fire hose perturbations go away, the magnetic energy has to decay. But the collisionless high beta system imposes a limit on how quickly anything can decay before it decaying will itself trigger instabilities.
Yeah, but does it really decay, or does it go to marginal stability at the marginal fire?
No, it decays. Well, because there's dissipation. So, I mean, it does go. It can go.
But I suspect that if you use
just wind up with a state in which you have marginal.
You mean with fluctuations marginal. Just sitting there forever?
Yeah, yeah, right.
Well, I suspect that's.
I mean, we tend yeah. to see in our uh-huh. older reconnection simulations at high beta.
Uh-huh.
We get these final state in which you get these weird shaped islands that are yes. just squiggly.
Yes.
They just sort of sit there.
So it's a kind of collisionless force-free state.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get the same thing from fire, but you get things that just sit there forever yeah. for some reason, yeah. and they keep scattering.
But there's no electric field, so I don't think there's any. Dissipation.
Well, we did see them decay
they
slowly.
They sort of sit there.
Maybe what you're talking about is what happens when beta is in the kind of an asymptotic limit of infinite beta, right? So we found that the things decay at a rate that's inversely proportional to beta. Hmm. So the higher you make the beta, the longer these things will sit, right? And the most simple explanation, which appears to match the data, was to say that the decay rate of this thing had to be itself be limited by...
But if you look at the time evolution,
uh-huh.
does the system evolve away from marginal fire hose as it's decaying?
Yes.
Yes.
It does.
It goes into more stable regime.
It does, yeah. Yeah.
It goes to sub-fire
hose. We don't have any good explanation for why this happens.
Yes, that's
it. Just does.
So it just kills the anisotropy.
It could just be the pig code. Like it could be that you know you put the fluctuations into a code, you let it be, it will decay, right? Just because there's no
there
is viscosity in the problem.
Well, you can see fluctuations. There's a lot of.
I mean, we always wondered whether there's a weird state in a real system
right.
in which you're locked in to marginal
yes.
fire hose,
uh-huh.
and you have this weird magnetic field which has no tension on it,
yes.
and so it's just sitting there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Squiggled up.
So I think the answer to this question is in simulations at least, is yes, but it doesn't survive forever in simulations. Whether it survives forever in nature is an interesting question, right?
Yeah.
It then becomes an interesting question, what happens if you have this sort of space filled with this kind of thicket of magnetic fields, and then you push on it?
Yeah.
What happens, right?
The magnetic field has no tension, so it can...
Does it well? So yes. So is it like pushing at a bunch of rubber bands, or is it like
Flappy
going
noodles.
Through a kind of a thicket of bush?
Floppy noodles.
Yeah.
Flappy
noodles. Right. Exactly.
Mario, if you compress the field, the energy of the plasma goes up. If you decompress the field, the energy of the plasma should go down.
I was expecting to see the thermal peak to move up and down as you compress and decompress.
That's what it does, no?
I don't see it. It goes. It only goes up for the thermal.
No. Look. Okay. So it goes. You say? You see? I mean, it does go a little bit.
Tail, but the majority of the population, the peak of the population, the thermal temperature, you think, should have...
It always gets up.
Well, it depends on how much...
Imagine if there was no fluctuation.
Yeah, it would still go. So long as your rate of change of pressure and stuff is the same sign as the rate of change of field, then you're increasing your thermal.
The example I just gave, if you compress the field energy goes up, if you decompress the field, this could go down. Do you agree with that?
No.
No. Okay.
Then with the degree of instability.
With no instability.
With no instability is not a relevant example for what you're trying to ask. Though. Because with no instabilities, you'll drive pre-frenation up, it'll get really large, and it'll come down to zero again. In that case, yeah, it'll go up and down. But as soon as you limit it, irrespective of fluctuations and things...
It makes it irreversible. Right.
I just want to test your code, because I wrote it, and I know that the I've never tested this regime, so it could be just scattering on something that's unrelated to this.
Agreed.
This is expected so long as you hit fire.
You expect scattering in the instabilities. I mean.
Right, but beyond that, you can do something. Like, did you check this part?
No, I haven't tested this particle here. Yeah, this is very preliminary. Yeah, I just wanted to show it. I think it's interesting, but we need to look more. Okay, so conclusions, pressure and anisotropy-driven instabilities can give rise to non-thermal energy spectra in different regimes. When beta is order unity and we amplify the magnetic field by large numbers, saying 3 or 6, we do get electrons with power loss of index 3.7, in the case of the ions, 3.4. I think I wanted to show this because I wanted to compare it with what reconnection does in terms of beta and sigma. And we see that this regime where beta is order unity and for the temperature that we used is where reconnection is not so efficient. Reconnection is more efficient when sigma is order unity or more and beta is low. So we are, in our case, like here. So when we go to large betas, then we don't expect this process to happen in the sense that the waves don't have this electric field that can accelerate particles. But we do see some sort of like irreversible heating that acts differently in different parts of the spectrum in principle. So the open questions, I think people already mentioned it in this talk. What is the long-term outcome of this? This is something that we are investigating, whether or not we reach some sort of a stationary regime in terms of the hardness of the spectrum. How this ion cyclotron and Wistler-driven acceleration apply to other regimes. I have some results on solar flare that I think are interesting, but I thought I was not going to have time to show them. And also, how does this non-thermal anisotropic viscosity affects electrons or relativistic pairs? I think this is also interesting to explore. Thank you.
Going back to the issue before, when you move the when you push the ions again, so I think that the. So it is different if you keep enforcing the shear at the boundaries mm-hmm. or at any place in the box.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understand that keeping the shear on the boundaries because that mimics the other angles in the disk
mm-hmm.
that is that we act
mm-hmm.
On the box that you're considering. But in the middle of the box, you want it to be self-consistent, I think.
Right. Right.
So there, if a proton gets scattered back, so it's slowly, at some point it's slower than the shear, the local shear. Now you have different ways of boosting this up. you can move its velocity in the shear direction up to what it used to be. Mm-hmm. Or you can, for instance, twist you can scatter the moment, the momentum, mm-hmm. back in that direction. In one case, you gave the particle energy, in the other, you didn't. There is a unique way of enforcing a shear.
I think it's unique. Can I give you that? I think I get your question. When I use these shearing coordinates, I'm not enforcing anything. I'm just using a different set of coordinates, period.
You should look at the equations. You're not solving normal equations. There's an extra force in there.
Right, but the force, there is no unique...
Can I finish the answer? So it's just a change of coordinate that produces weird Maxwell equations. But physically, what I'm doing is to look at the plasma in the shear frame, right? So I'm not forcing anything. The only place where I force things is in the boundary, because where I use that frame, but I assume periodic boundary conditions, that is equivalent to not using it, but boosting particles. So in terms of forcing the system, it is equivalent to use it in the normal shearing box or this,
But if the amplitude of the wave became so large that your ions are trying to turn around, what would happen? Is this where the approximation breaks, or something will happen in your simulation, or this can never happen?
If the whole profile breaks because the viscosity is so large that you produce clamps and stuff like that, that thing should happen also in the normal shearing box, in the one where you are. Right. So yes, so it's equally artificial in the sense that you keep pumping shear, right?
Yeah. Can you ever get to that region? Clumping or like turn?
No, I haven't seen, but I guess if you amplify the magnetic field for two lines, mm-hmm. if you are in the very relativistic region, probably you are going to break this thing.
But if you make the box larger, instead of having 2 Larmor radii, you have 10 Larmor radii in the middle where the shear is small, you will see this effect.
Right, because probably the clamps maybe are not resolving the size of this whatever instability that would break this whole thing. Yeah.
It's important that you're only restoring the shear at the boundaries and not in the middle of the box. I thought in the beginning, I thought you were restoring it everywhere.
Right.
Like when the ions were fixed.
No.
Yeah. Do you expect to develop a theory for the power of the
Yeah. It's not that difficult, actually. I mean, it's...
So what is the ingredient?
The diffusion, the energy diffusion coefficient of the particles.
And the escape is determined by how long you see this?
Well, here there will be no escape. It will be just a closed system.
No, but like there is some time to interact with those layers. Like, why doesn't it result in a drawing Maxwellian? Why does it result in a power line?
Because you have a heating that is provided by the anisotropic viscosity, but on top of that, you have the effect of this wave that distributes the energy, right? So that's, for me, a diffusive process in energy. So you have your distribution kind of flattens.
But that's just heating. Why does it make a power?
It's energy-dependent diffusion.
Well, that's why. I mean, I want to measure the diffusion coefficient and see if that leads you analytically to a power law. It usually does when people calculate diffusion coefficients and put it into the Fokker-Planck equation. They sometimes.
So it's actually very hard to get anything reasonable with DPP alone, because the stationary solution of diffusion equation, right, Fokker-Planck, would be F proportional to integral of dP over DPP. And then if your DPP is something like Bohm, then your spectrum is
if your
diffusion coefficient is something like 0.3, pp to the 0.3, then you will integrate to the positive power, and then, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right? So this power laws that you have are negative, like p to the minus 3 or something. How do you get this DPP? You can get DPP as a positive power in P, like P to the to the cube or p to the full force power. Yeah, and then, I mean, what kind of scattering process does this?
Well, small scale scattering. If at some point, if the part is, if the acceleration time, so the time that it takes to go from p to p plus delta p, increases more than linearly with p, as you said, like p cube, for instance, and so on, effectively is as if there were an escape, because the time that it takes get to go at larger distances, get at larger momentum, becomes increasingly longer. And that's how you can get a power law. And physically speaking, if you scatter on particles or on perturbations that are much smaller than the Larmor radius, you expect a diffusion coefficient that goes like spatial, that goes like p squared. And then the diffusion coefficient in momentum space is related to the one in space. So I think it makes sense.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well,
I mean,
p squared does not, you know, it still gives you p minus 1, right? That's a spectrum. It's still very, very shallow. I mean, I never saw that this DPP goes as p to the 5 or something. Has it been observed?
All right. Thank you, Mario.
Sure.